This is number 0097, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0097. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Robert J. Hachowski is the author of Unsolved, True Canadian Cold Cases. Did old cold cases back in the day go unsolved because forensic technology wasn't around then?
I believe a lot that other cases definitely would have been solved, were it that the forensics that we have now would have been available, say, back in 1967. That's just one of the factors. Others have to do with the time itself, people feeling intimidated back then, any witnesses not coming forward. In some cases, police following leads that perhaps could have gone in other directions. So I wouldn't say necessarily only to do with forensics, but that would be a large part of it, yes.
Dr. Dale Peterson is the author of 10 Ways to Add 10 Years to Your Life. He's an advocate against our society's growing use of cell phones and the cancer they may cause.
The United Kingdom has been on record for many years as stating that no child under the age of 8 should be allowed anywhere near a cell phone. After about 1,700 hours of use is when the risk for tumor development appears to really raise its ugly head.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge, including the story of a bus driver who regularly had sex on his bus with his girlfriend.
But you see, I cut to the chase on all these things. My main question about this is, did he or did he not charge her a fare? I don't mind him doing the musky-pupky on one of my buses, but I want to make sure she paid to get on that bus.
And of course, we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0097, is my niece, Yvette Samuel Baptiste. Thank you very much, Yvette, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File. Love you. Now, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? There's an old adage that says you should never pull a gun unless you're willing to use it. Now, the same might be said for lying down in front of cars. In Orlando, Florida, 25-year-old Joel Santos had had an argument with his girlfriend. That would be 26-year-old Glory Beth Santiago. She finally had enough and decided to leave, and so she got into the passenger seat of her cousin Christina Santiago's car. Desperately trying to get her to stay, Joel lied down in front of the car. However, neither of the two women saw him do this as the car started driving out of the parking lot, and they felt a big bump under the vehicle. Yep, it was Joel. When they stopped to investigate, they found Joel pinned underneath the tires and called 911. A police spokesperson said, "We don't believe this is anything intentional. They thought he had moved, but he laid down on the ground." Emergency crews had to use a jack to lift the car off of Santos, who was unconscious. He was taken to Orlando Regional Medical Center, suffering from several burns he sustained while under the car. The police also noted that Joel was under the influence of alcohol at the time. Of course he was. Please tell me that this relationship is over, by the way. And in Brownsville, Washington, a 38-year-old man broke into a home and stole the homeowner's daughter's laptop computer. Weird thing was, he was naked at the time. The homeowners called police and the burglar ran into the woods. Deputies called out to him and explained that if he didn't come out, they would send a dog in after him. He asked if he could put his clothes on first. They said no. So he walked out of the brush wearing just a baseball cap and boots. The guy eventually confessed that the computer was about 100 yards back in the woods with his clothes and blamed alcohol for his actions. Yes, alcohol again. Claiming he had a buzz on and was in the middle of a relapse. So they arrested him, and the arresting officer said he never explained why he took off his clothes. The wonderful things that alcohol makes people do. And moving right along, at the risk of never getting an ad on this show for Craigslist, let me state that I often find Craigslist to be more trouble than it's worth. From all the sorts of criminals looking for victims to hookers plying their trade, the world of Craigslist just seems to be a seedy lot. And now here's a new low: being punked on Craigslist. In Sheboygan, Wisconsin, Debbie Brown awoke at 7 a.m. to find about 18 people standing in her front yard, all wanting to take away her boat and minivan. They were responding to an ad on Craigslist which said both were free for the taking to anyone who wanted them. The only problem was that Debbie hadn't placed the ad, she doesn't know who did, and her boat and minivan are certainly not up for grabs. By late morning, more than 24 people had come by her home in response to the ad, which read, "If I'm napping, take my boat." Her daughter Felicia said her mother doesn't even know how to use a computer and certainly doesn't know anything about Craigslist. Debbie's now working with police to find out who posted the ad and is prepared to take legal action. And she had the ad removed immediately. Now, I have to admit, that was creative, but still, not cool. Not cool. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our first guest, just in time for summer, New York designer Andrew Schneider has invented a solar-powered bikini. So why would you need this? Well, so you can charge your iPod or cell phone while you bask in the sun, of course. Called the iKini, Schneider has sewn together 40 paper-thin photovoltaic panels together with soft conductive thread to produce his invention, which comes complete with USB ports sewn right into the fabric. Schneider says he came up with the idea during a brainstorming session at New York University. He's now working on his next big thing, shorts for men that can keep drinks cold, something he calls the iDrink. Okay. Lying in the sun in a bikini, inviting melanoma? Check. Adding radiation-induced devices plugged right into your swimwear? Double check. Let the cancer begin! Yes. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Robert J. Hachowski is a Canadian crime writer. He's the author of The Last to Die, which chronicles the last case of capital punishment in this country. He's also the author of Unsolved, True Canadian Cold Cases, his most recent book. He joins us on the line from Toronto. Hi, Robert. How are you?
I'm very well, Peter. How about yourself?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on with us. So, again, you keep in this vein of doing true crimes. What led you to Unsolved Cases in Canada, and were you surprised by the numbers of unsolved cases that there are?
Frankly, I was actually shocked by the number of unsolved cases. I know in Toronto, if you go by the first amalgamation, just as an example, going back to 1957, there's over 300 unsolved murders. That's just Toronto alone. And across Canada, there's literally thousands. And what basically led me to do the book was that after my first book, The Last to Die, came out in 2007, I knew that my next book was also going to be another true crime book. So I started doing some research, and I realized that there's an awful lot of unsolved cases, and quite a few had happened in, say, Ontario back in the 70s. So what I thought is I would come up with a certain model for the books, and that would be all the cases would be about 1965 or so to the present. So approximately a 40-45 year space for that.
Is part of the reason why these cases are unsolved is that forensic technology wasn't what it was back in the day? In other words, do you think a lot of these crimes would have been solved had they been perpetrated today, or would the numbers be just as high?
I believe a lot that other cases definitely would have been solved were it that the forensics that we have now would have been available, say, back in 1967. That's just one of the factors. Others are... have to do with the time itself, people feeling intimidated back then, any witnesses not coming forward. In some cases, police following leads that perhaps could have gone in other directions. There's one case in the book that has to deal with the belief that police had that a number of murders were the result of drug deals gone bad. And in effect, my book basically states that that wasn't the case at all. So I wouldn't say necessarily... only to do with forensics, but that would be a large part of it, yes.
Well, having said that, I don't want to point fingers at the police officers, but it sounds like I'm hearing in some cases that in some crimes, if the victim or victims aren't necessarily upstanding members of the community, that maybe the search for the killer isn't as forthright or pressed as it would be if it were someone else.
Yes. I would say that, and again, this is no way to flag the police, because I find that on the whole they do a very good job. It's also what the police have to deal with. And in my book, there's a number of cases that are very well known. There's quite a few that are actually virtually unknown, which I chose them deliberately because I feel that it's worth keeping them out there in the press. And two deal with some young girls, both in their early teens, whose parents put them up for foster care in the Toronto area. And they were both found murdered in what's a case referred to as the Pickering Gravel Pit Murders. And this was back in 1971, actually. And, you know, because these kids were in foster care, there wasn't really a lot of attention paid to them at the time, as opposed to them being, say, wealthy, which happened with another case in my book, like a wealthy businessman being killed.
Now, I've heard it mentioned by you on your own website that your books are, or this book in particular, Unsolved, the True Canadian Cold Cases, your book is different from other books that look at cold cases. How would you say it's different?
In quite a few ways, actually, Peter. What I did for this book is I tried to go through every single case with whatever information was available to the police at the time, and to build a trust with police, as you know, as a journalist, can sometimes take a little while, because there's a lot of people who have wanted to do books on unsolved crimes in Canada. And actually, a couple of the cases I worked on, family members had, in fact, been contacted by people saying, oh, I want to do a book, I want to interview you. But the books didn't ultimately come to fruition. What I did is I tried to go through every bit of information that was available that I could access to the police at the time, newspaper stories, and then I started on the process of contacting family members, friends, potential witnesses, private investigators, anyone who would have been connected, retired police. Retired police were actually a great source of information. And went through that with an eye for what would have happened were forensics available now that weren't available, say, in 1967.
How many murder cases are in your book?
There are 12 in there. Okay. 12 cases in total, actually. 10 are murder, 2 are disappearances.
The reason why I asked the question is 12 cases, that means out there are 12 murderers, at least.
At least.
At least. Are you concerned in bringing out a book like this that you're drawing the attention to 12 people who are still out there, perhaps hiding, and are now looking at you?
That's a good question. There was one case in particular, the disappearance of a girl named Crystal Elizabeth Van Hoeksloot back in 1977. Just to give you a quick bit of background, she was a girl from Edmonton who befriended and eventually started dating a drug dealer in Toronto who was incarcerated in the Don jail. She tried to raise a huge sum of money for his bail. I believe it was in the amount of $12,000, which back in the 70s was just enormous. She couldn't do it, so unfortunately she allied herself with certain nefarious people, including loan sharks. And as I outline in my book, she disappeared. People connected to her were found murdered. Two of them basically had their heads blown off. And the prime suspect in the case was found not guilty. So that was one of the cases that was suggested by quite a few people not to put in the book, but I put it in regardless.
Why were they telling you not to put it in the book, and why did you go about doing so?
The reasons not to put it in the book basically had to do with underworld connections.
Okay.
And the reason I put it in the book is because I feel that it's extremely important to get this case solved, not just for the girl herself, but for the family. I can't even envision, I mean, murder itself is horrific enough, but to know that your father, mother, child, son, brother, daughter, uncle, whatever, has disappeared, which happened in another case in my book, and you don't even know if they're alive, dead, were they abducted, were they mistreated, are they living in some other country, are they living under an assumed name, have they been raised by somebody else? I mean, that alone is, that, I think in some ways that's even worse than knowing the person is dead. And I only say it not from my perspective, Peter, but from the family's perspectives of people I've interviewed.
They often say, police often look towards people that the suspect, not the suspect, the victim knew, people who were related to them. You did the same groundwork in talking to people to write your book. Do you ever think of the possibility that in maybe one of these cases, you may have actually talked to the murderer?
For this book, probably not. I know that in certain cases people have actually suggested that, but I don't believe that. I do believe, however, that in a lot of the cases, there are people out there who know who the murderers are, and they haven't come forward over the years simply because they're afraid of the repercussions.
How is the book doing? It's been out for a while now, right?
It's been out for almost a year. It's actually done very well. I've had quite a few reviews and write-ups about it, and what I found interesting is that it's not just a matter when you're doing a book like this of dealing with police and becoming, you know, trustworthy to them, because they get approached by people all the time with, you know, tips and wanting information and things like that, but it's dealing with the families, and my book tends to focus less on the gruesome details, as did my first book, and more on the actual families and the impact on their lives.
And what reaction, if any, have you had from the families to your book?
Extremely favorable. Extremely favorable. Many are quite grateful that the book came out. They feel that it's worthwhile because it's keeping the names of their loved ones alive. And they still believe that there's a chance that the murders will be solved after so many years. I mean, all the cases I find are quite important to me in the book. One in particular, it's a double murder of two girls named Wendy Tedford and Donna Stern back in 1973. The sister of one of the murdered girls is still aggressively pursuing police for information after almost 40 years. And what's quite amazing to me is that she was telling me once just how tired she is because she's dealt with so many detectives, at least 20, she estimates, in all that time. Because what happens is, you know, eventually these officers will retire, and then the cold cases will be passed on to the next detective and the next one and the next one. And, you know, I know that this woman, her name is Linda, she won't give up until her sister's murder is found. There's absolutely no way.
I
have ultimate respect for her for that.
The book is called Unsolved, True Canadian Cold Cases, and it's written by Robert J. Hachowski. And Robert, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter.
Robert J. Hachowski, author of Unsolved, True Canadian Cold Cases. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0097, where you'll find links to Robert's website, plus links to Amazon.com, where you can order his book directly for the Kindle.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come in the program, we will talk to the author of 10 Ways to Add 10 Years to Your Life. We'll discuss the issue of the possible link between cancer and cell phones. And also Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. Plus, of course, there is an idiot of the day. But right now, more Stuff File news for you. Now, there are too many pesky geese at the New York City airport, and they're dangerous, too. They threaten the safety of departing planes. And remember the now famous Hudson River landing, Captain Sully Sullenberg? Right. Well, now there are also a lot of hungry people in Pennsylvania, so why not solve two problems at once? Yes, New York City plans to capture those unwanted geese and send them to Pennsylvania to be cooked for meals for the poor. The city will pay for the capture and transport of the geese, which will be distributed to Pennsylvania food banks. A spokesman for the city's Department of Environmental Protection said, "Rather than disposing of them in landfills, we wanted to make sure they're not going to waste." So why all the way to Pennsylvania? Well, get this. According to the DEP, nobody in New York was willing to take the geese as donations. Hey, Mom, what's for dinner? Aw, airport geese again? You know, the headline for the story could just have easily been New York killing Canadians to feed Pennsylvania. I'm just saying. Anyway, not quite sure what they're thinking, but a group of Japanese scientists have figured out a way to convert human waste sewage mud from Tokyo's sewers into edible meat. We're not kidding. The team of researchers discovered that the bacteria-rich human feces in sewers is also high in protein, so they decided to make it useful as meat. They've added enhancers and soy proteins as flavoring to the protein extracted from sewage mud, then put in food coloring to give it that meaty look. And honestly, is it really possible to add enough flavoring to this? Anyway, they actually call it feces steak and say it tastes just like beef. Wow, people who have tasted this must have in the past had some pretty horrible beef. The meat actually contains 63% protein, 25% carbohydrates, 3% lipids, and 9% minerals. And while it's a potential solution to world hunger, food safety experts warn that feces steak should be cooked and not eaten raw to eliminate any noxious pathogens. In the U.S., Douglas Powell, a professor of food safety at Kansas State University, says feces steak is really no different than edible plants fertilized with manure. Okay, they may be brilliant scientists, but their marketing department sucks. I mean, seriously, feces steak? That's the best you can come up with? You can't sugarcoat this a little more? Anyway, moving right along, those people we're fighting for over in Afghanistan can certainly be quirky. They are also very superstitious as a culture. Case in point, Afghanistan's booming car sales industry has been thrown into chaos by a sudden and growing aversion to the number 39, which almost overnight has become a symbol for pimp and a mark of shame in the deeply conservative country. Thus, drivers of cars with license plates that begin with the number 39 are now mocked and taunted. Speaking about his own vehicle that has an unfortunate 39 on its license tag, Mohammed Ashraf, who works for United Nations Project, says, "This car is a bad luck. I can't take my family out in it." Other 39 owners flew into a rage or refused to speak when asked about their cars. No one is quite sure why the number became so tainted so fast, but Kabul gossip blames a pimp in neighboring Iran, which shares a common language with much of Afghanistan. The story says that his flashy car's license tag started with the number 39, so he was nicknamed 39 and the tag spread. The number 39 scandal comes just weeks after drivers raced to remove rainbow decorations that were spotted on imported cars and became fashionable until conservative Afghans discovered that they also are gay pride symbols. Dealers say thousands of dollars in stock is now sitting unwanted on their lots, as even prime condition cars are almost unsaleable if their plates bear the now hated number 39. Well, you know, there are people in North America who won't drive a car with a license plate that includes 666, for instance. Lucky for us, here a license plate isn't permanently connected to a certain vehicle, you can just go to the motor vehicle department and get a new plate. Not the case in Afghanistan. Anyway, finally, one more story in our stuff file news before we get to our next guest. Usually, firing a gun in the air shouldn't be your first choice as a way to attract the attention of police, but when you've got a fishhook stuck in your rear end and you believe someone is breaking into your house, drastic measures are called for. In Frederick, Maryland, 52-year-old Charles Aiken Rempe thought somebody was breaking into his home, so he tried to flee, but in the process got a fishhook snagged in his butt. Afraid of the possible threat, Rempe then locked himself in the closet and started firing his gun in an attempt to attract police attention. Well, it worked. When officers came to Rempe's door investigating a noise complaint, Rempe told them he was happy they arrived. Police have not yet filed charges against Rempe, who remains hospitalized, but investigators plan to accuse him of discharging a firearm. Hospitalized? Man, that must be some nasty fish hook. Anyway, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. The World Health Organization has come out with a warning that radiation from cell phones may cause cancer. The international agency now lists mobile phone use in the same category as lead, engine exhaust, and chloroform. Watchdog doctor Dale Peterson, MD, has been studying the link and says radiation from cell phones is known to cause DNA damage and that people under 30 are most at risk to develop a brain tumor. He also is the author of 10 Ways to Add 10 Years to Your Life. And he's on the line with us right now from Oklahoma. Hi, Dr. Peterson.
Hello.
Thanks for being on with us. We are now hearing the situation about cell phones, which some people always suspected, some people thought about. I'm just wondering, are we in a time frame where it's very similar to, say, maybe the late 70s or late 60s, early 70s, when doctors started talking about the dangers of cigarettes, but the cigarette companies were still in denial? Are we there now with the phone companies?
We absolutely are. That's a perfect parallel, and I use it myself. If I go back to the 1950s, even early 1960s, I can show you articles in prestigious medical journals demonstrating that cigarette smokers are every bit as healthy as non-smokers. But I believe in looking at mechanisms. If I understand that inflammation sets the stage for cancer development, I don't have to wait decades to determine that inhaling hot noxious gases that inflame the lining of the mouth, the throat, the bronchial tube, voice box, is likely to result in increased numbers of cancer 20 or 30 years down the road. With the cell phones, there were studies done in 1995 by Drs. Lai and Singh, University of Washington, that demonstrated that exposure to the type of frequency of radiation that comes from a common cell phone at levels lower than those determined to be safe by federal agencies caused breaks in DNA. The significance of that is that breaks in DNA also sets the stage for development of cancer decades down the road. They were discounted at first, but subsequently researchers in Europe, researchers in China have confirmed their findings that exposure to cellular radiation does indeed cause breaks in DNA.
Now, using the cigarette analogy one more time, it seems to be, if I recall correctly, there were some cultures that per capita used to smoke more than North Americans. For instance, China, Japan come to mind back in the day when we were first being warned about cigarette smoking. Ironically, the same thing can be said for cell phone use. Certainly some European countries and certainly Japan have a higher propensity of cell phone users at a younger age than North Americans. Some people don't even have old-fashioned tethered to the base unit landlines. Everyone's using cell phones. So is that a greater source of research to watch what's happening in those countries in years to come?
What we're finding really is that tumor development with cell phones is related to hours of use. And so, yes, if there are societies that are using them more often, and they're using them at younger ages, by the way, it's not universal. The United Kingdom has been on record for many years as stating that no child under the age of 8 should be allowed anywhere near a cell phone.
But after about 1,700 hours of use is when the risk for tumor development appears to really raise its ugly head.
Well, and then the sad reality is, as you know, kids with cell phones, they can talk more than adults with cell phones.
Yes, and the thing that's really very concerning is that the major studies that were determined to supposedly prove that use of cell phones is not related to tumor growth excluded anyone under the age of 30 from participation. So while there are studies that have been done that have demonstrated that the risk of a tumor developing in a young person is as much as sevenfold greater than that in a full-grown adult, they have been specifically excluded from being looked at when studies have been done trying to prove or disprove any link to tumor growth.
Well, let's look at the other end of the cell phone spectrum, and that is, with the explosion of cell phone use, we're also seeing cell phone towers going up everywhere, literally in people's backyards. Should this be a concern?
It should be, because at this point in time, as we're speaking, every microwave looking for every cell phone on the North American continent is passing through us. And when I fly and get on a plane, before it will back from the gate, I'm instructed I'm to turn off my cell phone or other electronic devices. Why? Because they may interfere with the electronics in the cockpit and make takeoff or landing more dangerous. What we fail to recognize is the human body is not just structural, it's not just biochemical, but it is also electrical, it's also magnetic. And to suggest that a device is capable of interfering with electronics in the airplane cockpit, but incapable of interfering with the electronics in the human body, is just denying reality.
So are the lessons in any way, shape, or form finally sinking in? I mean, here you are talking about it. Are people starting to realize that this may be a problem? And if so, what's being done or what can be done about it?
Well, sadly, it's really not sinking in. There's a physician-based website called Medscape, and they published immediately a rebuttal to the World Health Organization cautionary statement. It was from a pediatric cancer specialist who insists that this is nonsense and there's absolutely nothing to worry about. He has not bothered to look at the information that's out there because he proclaimed there is no known mechanism of damage related to cellular radiation. What people can do, they can use the phone less. That's not likely to happen. They can hold it away from the body, which is difficult. I personally use devices that are manufactured to help counter the effects of the radiation on the human body. I can't tell you how they work. I can tell you that I can demonstrate immediate changes in reflexes in the body when a cell phone is held up to the head, and that those changes do not occur when the appliances are in use. There's one called EP2 that's a necklace that protects against the type of radiation coming from the towers that you speak of. The other is a little button that's placed on the phone itself to help to neutralize effects of the radiation.
How do you feel about things like using a Bluetooth?
Bluetooth may be better, but I'm not certain, because with the little blue or red, whatever color button, it's always flashing, it's always looking for the signal. Yes, the radiation may be lower, but it is continuous, and that is, to me, a concern.
So, again, with the whole Bluetooth situation, some people, obviously, with Bluetooth aren't putting the phone to their ear, but they have it kept to their side, they have it on their hip. Is there any concern about radiation in other parts of the body besides the brain?
Well, I believe there is. It's going to be very difficult to demonstrate that over time because it's not consistently usually used in various parts of the body. But if you go and look at cell phone manuals, particularly those for the new smartphones, the manufacturers specifically state that the device should not be held within 5/8 inch to an inch of the body.
Hmm.
So they're covering themselves.
is, do you see, even though the phone companies seem to be in some sort of denial, and certainly a lot of the general population, do you see with each generation of cell phones at least getting better, or are they not making any efforts to improve or minimize the radiation risk?
No, I don't believe that there's been significant improvement. As they become more sophisticated, we actually are using them more, requiring more energy for their use. And while the technologies are there for things like the EDOT, the little thing to put on the phone that helps to neutralize it, they're not incorporating that technology in their manufacture. They're just saying, no, there's not a problem, and moving forward.
The two things that you mentioned that might help reduce the amount of radiation one gets from a cell phone, those two items you mentioned, how do one find out more about that or find out about getting them?
You can find out more about them on my website, which is www.drdalepeterson.com. There's also a website called shopemf.com. Either place will give more information. If people go to my website, there are four articles up there on the world's largest experiment that go through a lot of the data on cell phone type radiation and human health. If they would like information specific to cell phones, they can request my newsletter and just put in the comments section, send cell phone article.
And that website is www.drdalepeterson, and it's drdalepeterson.com. Dale, you're also the author of 10 Ways to Add 10 Years to Your Life. I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us, Dr. Peterson.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Dale Peterson, the author of 10 Ways to Add 10 Years to Your Life. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0097, and you'll find links to Dr. Peterson's website to get his book, and also find that newsletter he mentioned on the studies dealing with cell phone use and cancer. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Have you noticed a lot more self-serve checkout lines at retail stores? I sure have, and I know there are a lot of reasons for this trend. Of course, a scanner cannot do everything a human cashier can, but for the retailer, that's not always such a bad thing. For example, a computer can't file a lawsuit, and here's why that's important. In California, a lawyer for an able-bodied checkout clerk used an obscure law to sue the employer for not providing chairs. Oh, the employees had chairs while they were on break, but they wanted them at the register too. And they won. Now, California's highest court has let the ruling stand, and retailers there are bracing for a wave of copycat lawsuits. Let's be fair, everyone deserves decent working conditions, but can it really be true that the only way to do a cashier's job is sitting on a chair? In today's economy, where jobs are scarce, we don't need courts forcing the private sector to go self-service. Learn more. Go to our website at centerforamerica.org.
What are they saying about if the rains don't cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Avidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Now, the Stuff File presents the Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, we do indeed have Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, from New York City. Hello, sir.
Hello, hello, live from the streets of New York.
Well, summer is actually here now, so let's talk about some of the things that's going on in your fair city. Now, I understand last summer, your mayor rolled out a new grading system for cleanliness in restaurants. So how's that working?
All right, one of the requirements we have in New York City is that every restaurant must have a menu in the window. And most restaurants do it. They do that so you can have an idea of what the price is, what you're getting yourself in for. So now we moved on to the next plateau. Every restaurant in the city of New York has to have a card, a sign in the window, big, maybe like a foot by a foot, actually, and it has to have either an A, B, C, D, or F on it, which would indicate the cleanliness of the restaurant. So they started, and they started inspecting all the restaurants, and lo and behold, all over the city, we're seeing nothing but A's and B's. That's nice, nothing but A's and B's. But then the people who run this program, the Department of Health, announced that what people were doing, restaurant people that is that if they got an A or a B, they would hang it in the window. If they got a C, D, or an F, they wouldn't hang it in the window, which, of course, is a violation of the law because that's the whole purpose of the law. And what they would say to out-of-towners like you, we haven't been rated yet. And what would then happen is that you would go in and get sick and die from ptomaine poisoning. So they're really clamping down, and they're going to start giving tickets to that and for people like that. And by the way, just speaking about that, a personal vendetta I'm on right now is TripAdvising sites where they will say with New York restaurants, it's wonderful, it's terrific, and blah, blah, blah. And in reality, I'm looking at them and say, what are you talking about? So I suspect, and this is an unsubstantiated allegation, that a lot of these TripAdvising sites, the stuff is being written either by the restaurants or maybe marketing people. So what does this all mean? It means, and there's no obligation, I'm not going to charge you anything. If anybody's made some plans to come to New York City, I'm not going to lay out your trip for you, but you can write to me and say, is such and such a hotel okay, or is such and such a restaurant okay? You know, and I'll say either I never heard anything bad about it or, yeah, stay away from it.
And we should mention, people can write to you by sending an email to peter@gabby.com. That's G-A-B-B-Y, gabby.com.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you when you were mentioning my name. That's terrible. don't ask me, what restaurant I should go to, what hotel I should go. No, I don't want to do that. You have to do your own research. And then ask me, is it okay to go to Peter Anthony's Holder restaurant on Lenox Avenue and 116th Street?
I got to tell you, and I won't mention the name, I went to a hotel in New York City, and this was several years ago, it was downtown. It was just horrid. Horrid. And I couldn't believe that something like that in that, and it was on the lower end of the price scale, because that's what I could afford at the time, and it was just terrible. And literally a block away was a brand new hotel. It was the same price, as a matter of fact, a few dollars cheaper, and it was literally night and day.
Well, the reason we have such a variety is because of the size of New York City. I mean, where else are you going to find thousands of restaurants and thousands of hotels? So what I recommend is people do a little research, disregard this nonsense on the web about which restaurant is good or not. I had this situation last week where somebody was saying to me, oh, they heard that Katz's Delicatessen is really fantastic. Its reviews are wonderful. I said, oh, you mean the place that just got 14 health violations from the city?
Ouch. Okay.
Well, it's true.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not out to get them, but I mean, just don't tell me it's a great place when it has 14 outstanding health violations. And by the way, you can go to the Board of Health of New York City, and they do rate the restaurants on the web, too.
And they have a website, yes, the Board of Health of New York.
Elsewhere
in New York, the Archbishop of New York has joined other religious leaders talking about the number of abortions in New York City.
Yeah, we're twice the national average in the United States. And putting aside the argument about abortions, whether they should be legal, whether they should be paid for by the government, because, you know, that's a fight that's been going on for years in the United States. It's a real hot potato, so to speak. But what the Cardinal is making the point at is that people in New York City appear to be using abortions as birth control, rather than using condoms, which, by the way, are given out by the city for nothing, you know, that type of thing. And it's a stirring point. It really is, because you can have one abortion, you can have two abortions. I mean, even from a woman's point of view, I can't imagine why she would want to have six abortions, you know, get smart and go to the drugstore. But in any event, they're going to start a little bit of a campaign about that. But as I say, on the other hand, New York is very, very open to sex done in the proper way. As a matter of fact, everybody in New York, 65 and older, is entitled to six free Cialis, Levitra, or which one did I forget? Viagra? Cialis. That's it. Yeah. They get six tablets a month.
Wow.
Free. So that means they don't have to get it from Canadian pharmaceutical companies. Well, that's where everybody in the United States buys their medicine from, except New York City.
Yeah, absolutely. Meanwhile, I understand that there's, Herbert H. Lehman High School has a new football field, but again, they might be good at construction, not good at math.
I think that's the problem. An American football field, I'm talking about American football, you know, with like, what was that Canadian guy I always talked to you about? He was Doug, the Canadian who played in the American football for a while.
Well, actually, you mean
Doug Flutie. See, my staff just said Doug Flutie.
You mean the American who played in the CFL?
Oh, wait, I said he was Canadian.
No, he's a good boy from Boston.
I didn't know that. Yeah. Anyway, I digressed again. It's 100 yards. If it's not 100 yards, you can't have a game because a regulation game. So when they built it, they made it 80 yards. So this particular high school has never, ever had a game, a real game. If they have to play somebody, they got to go to somebody else's school. So now the city decides to fix up their little stadium, put in new bathrooms, new locker rooms, do this, do that, fix the field, blah, blah. They did all of these things and spent $5 million, which is a lot of money to spend on a high school sporting venue. Well, guess what they forgot to fix? They didn't fix the field. So it's still only 80 yards. So now it's still 80 yards, and we're at $5 million. Isn't it nice to know we have such smart people running the New York City Board of Education?
Like I said, good with construction, not good with math.
I guess so.
And what's the old thing in construction? Measure twice, cut once?
Yeah, exactly. And everybody knows the 2x4 is not 2x4.
There you go. Okay, a couple of... Although I guess abortion could be a sex-related story too, but a couple of sex-related stories that I want to get to before we wrap things up. One dealing with a slightly touchy Long Island police officer.
Yeah, well, what he would do is if he would pull over a woman, and it's amazing that he would even have gotten away with doing this more than once, because it wasn't the first time when he just got caught, and he would say, "If you grope me." I mean, can you imagine a police officer standing there in the greater New York City area and saying, "If you grope me?" I mean, how about a Canadian Mountie? Oh, no, they would never do that. But anyway, the guy's going to lose his job. He's going to lose his pension, which is a bundle. And maybe he's going to lose his wife, like our Congressman Wiener. And it never ceases to amaze me. You know, you start being a cop at 18, let's say 19. You retire at 39. With life expectancy today, you're going to live to 79. So that means you've given up 40 years of your pension. I mean, that is really stupid cop.
So what he was doing was he was pulling women over, and he was saying, "You can get out of a ticket if you grope me." Is that what?
Grope him. See, there's the groper and the gropee. So I guess he wanted the groper as the ticket lady, and he was the gropee or something or other. By the way, I just want to make an announcement that we do not do that in the taxi industry, and we expect all you people to pay us when you get out of our cabs.
Okay, and while we're on that topic of a little, as you like to refer to it, muffky-fuffky, what's the story about a bus driver who wasn't going back to the garage, as they say?
Yeah, one of the longest bus rides you can take in New York City is from Manhattan to Staten Island, because you got to go out by way of the Brooklyn Bridge and all of that. So what this guy was doing is, at the end of the day, instead of taking the bus back to the garage, he'd go over to his girlfriend's area, pick her up, they go to a side street, and they do the muffky-fuffky. And they've been doing it for quite a while. Eventually, the supervisors started to get suspicious as to why he was always coming back late. You know, he blamed it on traffic and this, that, and the other thing. They followed him. They saw what was going on. But you see, I cut to the chase on all the things. My main question about this is, did he or did he not charge her a fare? Okay? I don't mind him doing the muffky-fuffky on one of my buses, but I want to make sure she paid to get on that bus.
Always the one for the rules, Mr. Franklin. Always one
for
the rules.
Well, listen, we got to be practical.
Absolutely.
Now, you realize, if I can add very quickly now, because I know you originate this broadcast from Montreal.
Yes.
Do you realize the damage that we've just done? we're going to have cops groping, bus drivers mufky-fufky. We may have just destroyed Montreal in one fell swoop.
Oh, I doubt that's going to be a problem here. Anyway, sir, always a pleasure to have you on the program. People can find out more information by going to your website, which is www.gabby.com. They could also send you an email to peter@gabby.com. I thank you once again, sir, for being on the program.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The Stuff File.
And we're almost done with this edition of the Stuff File program. We, of course, still have an idiot of the day. But before we get to that, a few Stuff File news stories, starting off with one from London. And you know, most people would think twice before buying a boat named Titanic 2. Sure enough, when Briton Mark Wilkinson took the 16-foot cabin cruiser out for its maiden voyage, it promptly sank. "If it wasn't for the harbor master, I would have gone down with the Titanic," Wilkinson, who had to be fished out of the sea at West Bay Harbor in Dorset, told local media. "It's all a bit embarrassing, and I got pretty fed up with people asking me if I hit an iceberg." Wilkinson had only recently bought the boat and brought it by road from his home in Birmingham for its first outing. After a successful fishing trip, things went wrong when he entered the harbor and the boat took on water. Wilkinson was forced to abandon ship. Pictures showed him clinging to a rail before he was rescued. One eyewitness said, and this is the quote of the day, "It wasn't a very big boat. I think an ice cube could have sunk it." Elsewhere, Gerald Christopher Priebe, age 35, of Clearwater, Florida, was charged with aggravated battery with a motor vehicle after injuring Terry Butler, age 53, in a hit-and-run accident. The charges were raised to attempted murder, and police are now investigating the incident as a possible hate crime. Butler is black, Priebe is white, and a witness heard Priebe yelling a racial slur as he allegedly purposely accelerated his vehicle toward Butler, who was standing on the side of the road. But that's not where the hate crime comes in. According to his interview with police, Priebe thought Butler was of Middle Eastern descent and therefore a possible terrorist. Thus, he felt it best to kill him. Isn't this pretty much what the terrorists wanted to accomplish, by the way, this whole fear thing going on? And finally, police in Durant, Oklahoma, responded to a burglar alarm at a warehouse and found Brent Eugene Walker, age 36, and Sheila Lynn Odom, age 28, inside the building. Walker told officers they weren't trying to steal anything, but rather they were just looking for a place to have sex. But the pile of loot on the floor put a lie to that, and the two were arrested on burglary charges. The property included extension cords, a surge protector, a can of Lysol, a paint sprayer, and two 50-foot rolls of copper tubing. Wait, did he say have sex or lay pipe? I'm not sure on this one. Anyway, time for our last story of the week, and that, of course, would be the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
State police say a man's efforts to ditch some drugs from a moving car in western New York didn't exactly go as planned. Troopers with the state police thruway detail say 20-year-old Sean Schmidt was standing with his upper body sticking out of the sunroof of a vehicle traveling on Interstate 190 in Buffalo. When a trooper following in a state police cruiser activated the car lights to pull over the vehicle, Schmidt threw a small bag of marijuana which landed on the hood of the trooper's car. Troopers say Schmidt was ticketed for marijuana possession and not wearing a seatbelt. If you are being chased by police and you're sticking out of a sunroof of a moving vehicle with a bag of weed in your hand, why, oh why, would you throw it in the direction of the vehicle pursuing you? Well, there's one reason and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0097. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, where you can find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0097. You could email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And you can find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Getting Jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.